From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Sheldon Harnick wrote the lyrics for one of the biggest hits in Broadway history, Fiddler on the Roof. That's quite a difference from Harnick's first assignments, writing for industrial shows. On this edition of Fresh Air, Sheldon Harnick tells us how he puts his words to music. Also, we look back on the Nixon years with Jonathan Schell. Schell wrote about Vietnam and the Nixon White House for The New Yorker magazine. Those essays have just been collected in a new book. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from the Ralph Peterson Quintet. And television critic David Bianculli takes a second look at the days and nights of Molly Dodd. NBC killed the series, but it's back with new episodes on cable. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is one of Broadway's great lyricists, Sheldon Harnick. With his former collaborator, Jerry Bock, Harnick wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, She Loves Me, Tenderloin, and The Apple Tree. Harnick and Bock ended their partnership in 1970 after their musical The Rothschilds. It's been over 10 years since Harnick had a new Broadway musical. His last one, Rex, was written with composer Richard Rodgers. In the past few years, Harnick has translated several operettas into English, including The Merry Widow. He's also working on a one-act opera in collaboration with composer Jonathan Tunick, and a musical version of It's a Wonderful Life, which Harnick hopes will open on Broadway after some legal problems are ironed out. Of all his musicals, one of Harnick's favorites is She Loves Me. It opened in April of 1963 and closed 8.5 months later. Now the Opera Ensemble of New York will stage a production of She Loves Me in early May. The original cast recording, which has been long out of print, was recently reissued on CD by Polydor.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah, now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, tomorrow, ah, my teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now. Discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me.
Sheldon Harnick, welcome to Fresh Air. Is this very good news for you that She Loves Me has been reissued? Are you glad to see it back in print again?
Oh, it certainly is. Because along with Fiddler on the Roof, I think it's the favorite show that I've ever been connected with.
It closed after a little over 300 performances.
That's correct.
On Broadway. The liner notes were written by the producer of this reissue, Larry Lash, and he implies that audiences really wanted brassier entertainment than She Loves Me at the time that it opened on Broadway. What was the context that it opened in?
The context meaning other shows?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was 1963. Oh, I don't remember what the other shows were. But I think it's true that She Loves Me is a very literate, rather gentle show. And as some people have called it, caviar, it seemed at the time to have a limited audience that... As a matter of fact, when it closed, I was quite distressed because I loved the show so. And for about 2 years, if I remember correctly, it seemed to be dead, which was both bewildering and depressing. But through the years, it got performances, and I began to get letters. Jerry Bock and I both got letters from companies who performed it saying, we love the show, we love to perform it, and that was gratifying. And over the years, little by little, it's made its way into the mainstream of shows that get performed.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the title song that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
The initial rhymes are really repetitions. She loves me, but she doesn't know it. No, she loves me, but she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it?
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your mind when you're using, say, two its instead of rhyming an it with a sit or an it with a bit, but to reuse that word?
Oh, that's a different kind of rhyme. The rhyme is not it. If you'll notice, the accent is on the prior syllable, show it, know it, and that's done all the time. If it were one word, it would be like action, faction.
Mm-hmm.
So that that's the rhyme is not necessarily on the last syllable. It's where the stress is. And in those cases, the stress is on show and on know.
I like the line, "My teeth ache from the urge to touch her."
Well, that's an extremely personal line. I was trying to use myself as George, and I realized that there are situations with some women where whatever the feelings are, they get me right in the back of the teeth. Now, I had a friend who, not having had that experience, he said, "What kind of a line is that?" He said, "I love you, and my foot hurts." You know, so it was very personal to me, and I just hoped that other people either would identify with it or at least understand what I was saying.
I want to play the opening number that you wrote the lyrics for "She Loves Me." This is called "Good Morning, Good Day." But before we hear it, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the function that this song had to serve within the play, because opening numbers are really important. They have to set the tone for everything that's going to follow, and they frequently have to introduce the characters as well.
Right.
What are some of the functions this song had to play when you were writing it?
Well, I guess the main thing that the song did was to set the tone of the show, and for good or for bad, it's a gentle tone. It's not a razzle-dazzle opening number. Also, the number lyrics and music interweave with some of Joe Masteroff's dialogue. So it was really a delineation of character at the top of the show, the people we were going to be spending the next 2 hours with. And mostly it was that. It was getting you to know them, getting you to get a sense of the fact that they're comrades in this shop that they all work in.
Okay, let's hear a part of "Good Morning, Good Day" with the lyrics by my guest Sheldon Harnick.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this beautiful day? Isn't this a beautiful morning?
Very.
Hey, see, boss, how's this?
That's a very elegant pose, but is all that elegance necessary?
And why not? I represent Marichek's, don't I? We're not a butcher shop or a hardware store. We're a perfumery, and that means we're
stylish.
That's it.
With a quiet dignity.
Yes, and we get the tilt of our hats right.
That's right.
When I ride my bike, people see what Marichek's like. So I think it's very important that I look my best. Here comes Miss Ritter.
Miss Ritter.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me and I'll put my...
You know, listening to that, it's easy for me to understand why you're doing operettas now and one-act operas. I seem to hear a connection between some of the writing that you did for She Loves Me.
Right. I'm sure I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I think I was leaning towards that kind of through-composed style where it would be either sung all the way through or a mix of music and dialogue that totaled up to almost a complete musical experience.
When you're writing a lyric, do you find that you frequently throw out the first few versions of it before you come up with the one you like, or are you lucky enough to hit on it the first time?
Well, what I find, funny you should say that, I haven't thought about this for a while, but what I find is quite often the first version of a lyric, it's not that the lyric won't be technically good, and the idea may even be good, but what I find is I don't know the character well enough yet, so that as my acquaintance with the character deepens, then I will look at that lyric and no longer be satisfied with it and think, no, that's really not what the character would say at this time, so that I throw it out and start over again. And if I'm lucky, I'm able to salvage some of the better lines from the song.
Do you allow yourself to use the same rhyme twice in different songs?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean.
Say you used a rhyme 15 years ago in a song.
Oh.
And those particular words will work just fine in a song you're working on now. Will you rule it out because you already used it once?
If it's a trick rhyme, yeah, I'll rule it out. I try and avoid that. Sometimes, of course, you don't remember. What's more difficult, I once asked Ogden Nash, a man I loved, and I loved his work. I was his assistant for a television show years ago called Art Carney Meets Peter and the Wolf, so I got to meet him and work with him. And I said, what happened? Well, how do you feel if you write a rhyme that you feel is original with you, and then you hear another song, an earlier song where that rhyme has been used? What, do you have to go back and rewrite? And Ogden started laughing. He said, oh my, he said, I write rhymes and I'm so proud of myself. I think they're fresh and new. And then I find out that Larry Hart wrote them 20 years ago. And he said, all I can tell you is if you feel that you've created that rhyme, then use it. He said, there's no reason to change it just because someone else has. And as a matter of fact, I've started reading poetry late in my life. In the last 8 years or so, I've been going through poetry. And I find with Browning and with Lowell and people like that, they've used all of those complicated rhymes a century before we did.
And that doesn't bother you, though?
No.
What are you learning from reading poetry that applies to songs?
I think what I'm learning is that the great poets, not even the great poets, the minor poets, all good poets, have a genuine care for using the right word in the right place. I think that comes through, and it makes you want to, it inspires you to do the same, to be careful, to write with as great care as possible so that you really express what it is that you yourself are feeling.
You never write pop songs, at least not that I know of. All of your songs are written in the context of a show.
Right. I learned very early that was not my talent. I was quite disappointed when I discovered that, because when I came to New York from Chicago, it was with the idea of being another Irving Berlin, writing for the theater and having songs come out of it that were pop hits. And little by little, as I talked to people and as I looked around and as I was honest with myself, I thought, no, that's not the way I write. So I was hoping that ultimately some of the songs from the shows would become standards, and that's what happened. There's been a few.
Well, what did make you realize that your gift was for writing songs within shows and not just pop songs?
Well, I think there were two experiences, I think. One, I hadn't been in New York too long when I had four songs in an off-Broadway review called the Shoestring Review, and they got very nice press. So I was invited up to meet a publisher in the pop field, and I played him my stuff. And after I did, they said, well, your work is too filled with ideas. It's not simple enough for what we want is something much simpler. And I thought, I guess that's true, but I write complicated most of the time, or at least I do try and put ideas in. I thought, well, if that's the case, that's the case. Then the other experience was, after I had met Jerry Bock and we started to work together, there was a period when we didn't particularly have a show to work on, so we worked on a lot of what were meant to be pop songs, and we didn't sell any of them. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and thought, well, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm. Before you started working with composer Jerry Bock, you were writing music for your own songs, and I think it was Yip Harburg, the lyricist who's probably best known for writing lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, who told you to stick to lyrics. Was that good advice?
Yes. Well, it certainly facilitated my career. What he did was to tell me that, in his estimation at that time, this was the early 50s, that there were more capable theater composers than there were capable theater lyricists. So what he actually said was, if you can facilitate your career by agreeing to collaborate with other composers instead of writing music yourself. And that's what I did. Shortly before he died, as a matter of fact, he told a good friend of mine, Madeline Guilford, who was a very close friend of his, my name came up in a conversation they were having, and Yip said, I wonder if I did that young man a disservice. He said his music was fine, but I wanted him to get ahead faster, so I wanted him to work with other people, and I hope I didn't steer him away from writing his own music.
I think one of the things that would be really nice about writing lyrics to somebody else's music is that you've got a variety of lines to write to. That you've got, if the music's coming first, you have somebody else's lines to fit your words and rhymes to, and that there'd be less of a possibility of getting stuck or of rewriting the same song.
Well, there's always the possibility of getting stuck. But what what is wonderful about writing with someone else, there's two things that come to mind. One is that music, although people consider it as an abstract art form, music to me is very concrete. Music says certain things, so that when I hear a piece of music, when Jerry used to give me a tape with a lot of new music on it, music suggests ideas, music suggests emotions and moods, and I would find myself getting ideas for lyrics that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't heard those pieces of music. So that was wonderful. The other thing is, as you were implying, one of the difficult things to create in writing a lyric is the form of the lyric, or at least it's difficult for me. Maybe other people don't have that problem. But to create a fresh form is not always easy. And when someone gives you a piece of music, the form is there. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the other things, singability and clarity and rhyme and things like that.
Stephen Sondheim, back at his lecture on lyrics that he gave at the New York Y years ago, this was in the 1970s, said that you were one of his favorite lyricists and that he liked your work for its grace, its charm, and its perfection of setting. And I think that perfection of setting has really been an important one for you. When I think of the different kinds of settings you've had to write for, Fiorello, which is about New York politics, Fiddler on the Roof, which is set in an Eastern European shtetl. I mean, those are two really different extremes that you had to write lyrics for.
Mm-hmm. I do my research, and as a matter of fact, I think that accounts for the least successful show that I did.
Which one?
The first one with Jerry Bock. It was called The Body Beautiful. And I accepted the show because I was very hungry to get a show on Broadway, but it was not the show I should have done. It was about boxing. And boxing was a sport and a milieu that I really had almost no interest in. So although I did my research, my heart wasn't in it.
Well, Fiddler on the Roof, which was a very unusual setting, the Eastern European shtetl, was one of your most successful shows, one of the most successful shows on Broadway, probably. This was one of the shows that you initiated the idea for.
Right. A friend had sent me a novel by Shalom Aleichem, a book called Wandering Star, about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring all over Russia and Poland. And I loved it. I gave it to Jerry Bock to read. He loved it. And we gave it to Joe Stein to read. Joe read it, and he said, it's too sprawling. It covers 40 years. It has a cast. I mean, it has about 80 characters. It's just too big. He said, but the writing is wonderful, and it's very inherently musical. Why don't we look for more things by Shalom Aleichem? So we did, and we found the Tevye stories, which we then optioned and began the project ourselves.
Well, I want to talk with you a little bit more about Fiddler on the Roof and your other shows, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics for such shows as Fiorello, Fiddler on the Roof, and She Loves Me. She Loves Me has just been reissued, and it's been remixed as well. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick is my guest. We were talking before about songs that do and don't have lives outside of the show, and you said you always wanted to write songs that would have a life outside of the show. I think the songs in Fiddler on the Roof certainly did, and I think especially of Sunrise Sunset, about how many weddings that
right.
song has been sung at. Have you been to weddings where they sang that song?
I've not only been to weddings where they've sung that song, but I have a number of friends who've asked me and my wife to sing that song. For instance, Alan Alda's daughter got married, and one of his daughters got married, and Margie and I sang there. So we've sung the song ourselves at a number of weddings.
Can I ask you to recite the lyrics from the song?
Or the opening? I think I can remember the first chorus, anyway.
Okay.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall? Wasn't it yesterday that they were small? Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears.
What came first in that song when you were writing it?
The music. And I remember it very vividly. Jerry Bock was living in New Rochelle at the time, and I would take the train out there. We would go into his basement where he had a studio. And he played me the music for Sunrise Sunset. And I was so moved by it. I had the experience of having, I've used this phrase describing this experience before, I had the experience of having lyrics kind of crystallize on the notes. It came out very fast, very rapidly. And we were both so thrilled with it that we called Jerry's wife, Patty. We said, come down, come down. She ran down to the basement, and we played it, and she wept.
That was a good sign, huh?
Yes.
Did you learn about writing songs in settings by some of the early work that you did for industries? You wrote a lot of industrial shows, I think, for places like Esso and Nabisco, Buick. What did you write songs for them?
They had an interesting policy. They used standard music. My job was to take the material they did, the points they wanted to make. Most of the shows I did were for salesmen, either introducing a new product or a new slogan or just making them more enthusiastic about what they were doing. So that my job was fitting this material into existing music. They felt that it was enough to give their audiences the message without asking them to absorb new melodies as well. And as a matter of fact, later they got sued for this because I didn't know at the time that they hadn't been paying the composers. As a matter of fact, I did a long lyric to the Meredith Willson's song Trouble, and somebody who was in the industrial show that we did was a friend of Meredith Willson's, and he called Meredith Willson not to complain, but just to say what fun it was doing this new lyric to Meredith Willson's tune. And Wilson, of course, was shocked. He said, "What do you mean? Nobody asked me for my permission." But what that experience did for me was to refine my craft, because especially for an industrial show, everything had to be done with the greatest possible clarity, the greatest possible economy, and the greatest possible effectiveness. So it was learning to hone my skills.
Do you remember any of the lyrics you wrote for those industrials?
Oh, no, that was...
too long ago.
That's too long ago. That's about 30 years ago.
When you're looking at a book that you're going to be writing the lyrics for, how do you know where the songs go? What makes the place in a Broadway book for a song?
Well, there can be a number of different places. One, of course, which we're all taught, is that one looks for the emotional high point of the scene, where the emotion is so strong that the words want to start soaring. Instead of just being spoken, you want the addition of music to deepen the emotion. But also, there can be a spot, for instance, in Fiorello, as Jerome Wideman wrote the book, he had a scene in a political clubhouse where the men were playing poker. And I thought, oh my, I played a lot of poker in the Army, and I remembered a lot of the colorful lingo that went with poker, and I thought, I want to use that lingo for a colorful lyric. So I spoke to Jerome Wideman, and I said, I want to borrow some of your lines, and I want to change a large part of this poker game into music. And he said, be my guest. He was very generous, so I did that.
You remember any of the lyric?
Oh,
this is politics and poker.
This is politics
about, right?
And politics and poker. Well, the first part was all that King Betts. I panic whenever anybody asks me to remember one of my lyrics. But it's
feel like an imposter when that happens.
They'll see right through me. They'll see that I have this small boy who comes in and does all my lyrics for me.
You're working on a lot of new projects now.
Yeah.
Would you tell us about one of them, the one that you're really looking forward to?
I have no favorites.
Okay. One of
the ones that the most frustrating, with composer Joe Raposo, we did an adaptation of the old film It's a Wonderful Life. And what we did everything we were supposed to do, our producers did. They did a copyright search. And we discovered later that there were very bizarre copyright problems that none of us expected. And so we're still trying to iron those out. I hope we'll iron them out soon, because we've tried the show at the University of Michigan, where it went wonderfully well. It's ready for Broadway, and if we can just clear up those problems, we'll have, I think, a wonderful show to bring in.
How have things changed in terms of trying out a show before bringing it to Broadway?
Well, it's just so costly to take a show on the road. It may add, I don't know, maybe another $1 million to the budget. It's just everything costs so much. Traveling, transportation, the cost of the musicians, the cost of the actors, the per diems on the road, everything just costs so much that, as we've seen, shows arrive now from England where they're tried out. Of course, the English don't consider it a tryout. They consider it their theater. But in many ways, our producers consider it a tryout, that it's much cheaper to mount a show over there. And they, so if something's a hit, then it they risk bringing it in. Otherwise, shows tend to arise in other cities around this country. And then a producer will get to see them and then, again, risk bringing them in. There are fewer and fewer shows that seem to originate on Broadway, which is a shame.
Do you miss Broadway when you don't have a show that's open there?
Well, there's two things about Broadway that no other venue can provide. One is the immediate launching of a show. When you do a show on Broadway, even a flop, people know about it all over the country. And if it's a hit, they may know about it all over the world. Whereas if you start a show that's a success in some other city, little by little, it has to make its way into the news and it has to make its way into the stream of things that get produced. And then, of course, for a writer, the other thing is that the money that comes in for a Broadway success is enough to enable you to devote your life to writing. If you don't have that kind of royalty coming in, then you have to teach or you have to find another profession that will support you to support your writing habit.
You haven't had to do that, have you?
Not since Fiorello.
Right, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
One last question. When you're writing lyrics for a song, where are you? At the piano, at the desk, on the couch, driving in the car?
I'm various places. Where I prefer to be when I start is in a reclining chair. And on a little end table next to the chair is my thesaurus and my rhyming dictionary if I need them. But I like to be quiet and calm and just in a position to think and hoping that the phone won't ring because I'm a compulsive answerer. Then once the lyric is started and it reaches a point where I'm excited about what I'm doing, then it can be on a subway, on a train, walking around the city. In fact, I have to be careful that I don't walk right out into traffic.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
The original cast recording of the 1963 musical She Loves Me, with lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, has been reissued on CD by Polydor. The Opera Ensemble of New York will stage a production of the musical during the first 2 weeks in May. Harnick's other Broadway hits include Fiorello and Fiddler on the Roof. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll talk baseball with sports writer Tom Boswell. Considered to be one of the most literate and thoughtful sports writers around, Boswell writes a column for the Washington Post and comments on sports for National Public Radio. He has a new collection of articles on baseball called The Heart of the Order. I hope you can join us.
Ah, I'm tingling, such delicious tingles. I'm trembling, what the hell does that mean? I'm freezing, that's because it's cold out. But still I'm incandescent, and like some adolescent, I'd like to sprawl on every wall I see. She loves me. She loves me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been a decade and a half since the fall of the Nixon White House, and like many of us, writer Jonathan Schell found his memories had faded with time. Schell took a second look at the Nixon years while assembling his new collection of New Yorker essays from the period. Coming up, Jonathan Schell on Nixon, Then and Now. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from the Ralph Peterson Quintet. Kevin says it's one of the best examples around of the bebop revival. And television critic David Bianculli looks at another revival, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. The former NBC series is back with the original cast and all new episodes on cable. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. In a historic moment, the House Ethics Committee today produced its long-awaited report on the investigation concerning House Speaker Jim Wright. The committee has found reason to believe the Speaker violated House rules 69 times. NPR's Cokie Roberts has details.
The Ethics Committee Chairman, California Democrat Julian Dixon, made the announcement this morning with all the other members of the Ethics Committee around him. The most crushing news of all for Jim Wright, that the committee voted unanimously to issue the alleged statement of violations. The Democrats could no longer charge that this was a purely partisan attack on their speaker. Dixon emphasized the committee had dropped several charges, that members did not believe Wright had violated rules in his dealings with the Home Loan Bank Board or in lobbying on behalf of Texas oil and gas interests or in the publication of his book. But the committee did find that Wright's gifts from businessman George Malik, when Malik had an interest in legislation, could constitute a violation of the rules, and that his sale of his book in bulk could be an attempt to skirt outside income limits. The speaker is asked to answer the charges as soon as possible. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Texas Air Corporation said today it does not want to sell off its Eastern Airlines subsidiary. The news followed a decision by a federal bankruptcy judge to give Eastern and its creditors one more week to come up with a reorganization plan. Under the reorganization, Texas Air said a substantial portion of Eastern's assets would be sold, raising large sums of cash and enabling the strike-bound carrier to pay off much of its debt. A planned sale of Eastern last week to former baseball commissioner Peter Uberoff fell through because of a dispute between Texas Air Chairman Frank Lorenzo and Eastern's striking unions. Eastern Airlines absorbed more problems today. The Customs Service in Miami discovered 75 pounds of cocaine aboard an Eastern airliner and seized the jet pending payment of a fine. Rick Stone reports.
It was flight 908 from Paraguay by way of Lima, La Paz, and Panama City. When it landed Saturday at Miami International Airport, customs inspectors found the drugs hidden in a courier bag. It was the 14th such discovery in 7 months and the ninth time the smugglers had used courier bags. Exasperated at what he called Eastern's failure to exercise due care, Regional Customs Commissioner George Heavey ordered the 727 impounded, pending a substantial down payment on $1.2 million in fines.
We might be accused of kicking a person or an airline when they're down, but the U.S. Customs Service will not tolerate drugs.
Heavey found this case particularly aggravating. If I tell you 8 out of 14 times that you have drugs in courier bags, he said, why should there be a ninth time? Customs is already holding $2.9 million in Eastern letters of credit posted as fines in previous drug seizures. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
Cheers broke out in a Warsaw courtroom today as a judge lifted a 7-year ban and legalized the Solidarity Trade Union. Speaking in Michigan, President Bush praised recent political reforms in Poland, and he unveiled a package of economic aid to encourage further progress. France, too, said it would help ease Poland's crippling foreign debt. Thousands of Chinese students calling for democracy have staged a major pre-dawn protest in Beijing. One student was arrested. Campus unrest began Saturday in China following the death of ousted Communist Party chief Hu Yobang. Campus protests nationwide 2 years ago led to the dismissal of Hu, then considered one of China's more liberal leaders. On Wall Street, stock prices rose fractionally today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.73 to close at 2337.79. Declines led advances on volume of 129 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During the 1980s, the popularity of trumpeter Wynton Marsalis's bands prompted a revitalization of mainstream jazz. Marsalis and other younger musicians, including his brother Branford and the Donald Harris and Terrence Blanchard Quintet, play a sleek, modernized music indebted to the great bebop artists. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of an album by another neo-bop band, led by drummer Ralph Peterson. Until recently, Peterson was playing with the band OTB, and he currently plays with trombonist Craig Harris. But the album V is Peterson's first as a leader.
Ralph Peterson Quintet's album V on Blue Note Records is one of the most impressive debuts any young bopper has made in years. It reveals not just Peterson's sterling chops as a drummer, but also a strong vision of what a modern bop group can and should do. His music is straight out of the jazz mainstream, but it's no rehash of elder players' triumphs. Where other boppers limit their range of expression one way or another, Ralph Peterson delights in maximizing his. An appreciation of his talents should begin with his playing. Peterson's one of the more creative drummers currently working, old or young. He's at his very best when backing a soloist. Listen to the variety of sounds he employs, murmuring tom-toms, thumping bass drum, crashing cymbals, when he plays behind his old boss, trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. The tune is Peterson's own, Bebop Scaroni. Ralph Peterson's skills as an accompanist are likely the reason he's so sensitive to one area of expression many jazz musicians ignore, dynamics, the shading of loudness and softness. Peterson's composition, Enemy Within, shows how dramatically he can vary dynamics, tempo, and intensity from one phrase to the next without sacrificing anything in the way of swing. Tribute to Peterson, the drummer and leader, that trumpeter Terrence Blanchard sounds better on this album than he does on many of his own. Bassist Phil Bowler is an old compatriot of Peterson's from Blanchard's group. Rounding out the quintet are the alto and soprano sax firebrand Steve Wilson, making his debut on record, and pianist Jerry Allen. Allen doesn't often record in such bopping contexts, but her distinctive approach gives this album much of its character. The bassist, saxophonist, and pianist all shine on Peterson's tricky composition, Moniev, which alternates two bars of 5/8 time with one bar in 7/8. Even more impressive than the technical mastery Ralph Peterson displays on his new album is the abundant energy and spirit it radiates. Some young musicians make modern jazz sound like painfully serious stuff, but Peterson's quintet seems to be having a great time, and the good fun is infectious.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Ralph Peterson's album V is on Blue Note Records. This is Fresh Air. Writer Jonathan Schell is best known for his book The Fate of the Earth, an examination of how life has been changed by the existence of nuclear weapons. Published in 1982, it was quickly dubbed the Bible of the disarmament movement, although Schell says when he started the book, there was no movement. Controversy is no stranger to Schell because the topics he writes about are both politically and emotionally charged. He began his career at The New Yorker, writing about the Vietnam War, the Nixon White House, and later the Watergate crisis. For a while, word was Schell was being groomed as the successor to New Yorker editor William Shawn. Schell left The New Yorker in 1988, at about the same time the magazine changed ownership and Shawn resigned. Schell's notes and comments pieces from The New Yorker are collected in a new book called Observing the Nixon Years. I asked him how he came to write about Vietnam.
Well, it's something I thought of doing for quite a while. But it seemed wrong to try to do it as long as I was continuing to write notes and comment for The New Yorker because, as you know, those are not signed pieces. They really spoke for the magazine. And so to come out and affix my name on them seemed wrong as long as I was writing them. But now that I've stopped, there seemed to be a justification for doing that.
I assume that you reread all the pieces before they were compiled in this anthology.
Yes.
Was it like a flashback for you, reliving those years?
Well, yes. It was. It was surprising in many ways to be reminded of what was going on back then, of how dire things really became.
What were some of the feelings that came back to you that surprised you?
Well, I think the feeling of the precariousness of our whole governmental system, of our constitutional system, especially in the later years of the war in Vietnam and the early years of Watergate. It became very clear to me. I felt it at the time, but I felt it in a new way, perhaps, looking back, that we were really on a razor's edge there in those very last years when the war was coming to its end and at the same time the Watergate crisis was unfolding. And the reason for that is that The thing I specifically feared the most at the time was that the victory of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, which I regarded as inevitable, I feared that that would come while Richard Nixon was still in office. And since he was on record publicly as saying that really the freedom of the whole free world depended on the survival of that regime, I feared that he would take drastic action if it began to crumble. And now, as we know, of course, he made secret promises to President Chu of South Vietnam to reintervene in the war. Finally, we know that he did, in fact, launch that terrible so-called Christmas bombing by B-52s of Hanoi just before signing the peace agreement, as a reminder, really, to the North Vietnamese that that they'd better not try anything because his response would be savage. So I think it was a great piece of good fortune for this country that Richard Nixon was removed from office before South Vietnam fell to the communist forces.
You were in Vietnam during part of 1966 and 1967 on assignment for The New Yorker.
Yes.
Why did you want to go to Vietnam to write about it?
Well, it was a little accidental, frankly. I had been living and studying in Japan for a year and a half, and I had a ticket home that permitted me to stop anywhere around the world. And in a slightly haphazard way, I stopped in Vietnam and formed the ambition to try to write something about it, and eventually did so. So it was there was a large element of accident there.
Were you of draft age?
Yes.
And how did you handle that?
Well, I was a student, and I had a student deferment.
Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself still getting into the same debates that you did 20 years ago?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. And there's a very specific reason for that. And it's that the overall justification for the war in Vietnam has been used again to justify intervention in Central America, for example. And although people are fond of saying Vietnam is not Latin America, and that's decidedly so, the policy by which the government justifies its action in Latin America is the same as the one in Vietnam. And that policy says that we have to fight every local rebellion and revolution as if it were really the advance wave of an assault by Moscow on the United States. It's a little hard to maintain that in the era of glasnost, but still it goes on. And so I do find myself in some of those same arguments because I have the same, there's the same underlying policy in effect, and I think it's wrong.
I want to ask you about a previous book of yours, Fate of the Earth, which was basically a philosophical inquiry into what it means to live with nuclear weapons and with the possibility of extinction. What led you to this subject?
I was thinking about politics. I was thinking about the Vietnam War. I was thinking about our domestic politics. And the more I thought about all those things, the more I found it necessary to think about the nuclear question. It was as if no matter what subject you pursued, eventually it led to that.
One of your observations that really stuck with me is your observation that you can't get rid of knowledge. You can't get rid of the knowledge of how to destroy ourselves. Once the scientific discovery of the bomb is made, you can't get rid of it. Even if you ban the weapons and tear down the factories, the knowledge exists to build them all over again.
It does. But I believe we can get rid of the weapons, nevertheless. And actually, one of the reasons is the very fact that the knowledge is there. Because anybody who would try to reintroduce them into a world from which they'd been removed would have to know that that the adversary or any number of adversaries could do likewise. And so it would be just as fruitless to head down the path of nuclear conflict.
So you still advocate complete disarmament?
Definitely.
Nuclear disarmament.
Yeah.
A lot of policymakers called your book naive.
Yes.
What was your response to that?
Well, you know, the threat that faces us is ending human life. And if it's realistic to do that, then I'm happy to be naive.
There were accusations after the book was published that you had plagiarized certain ideas from a book by a German philosopher on the atomic age. How was that resolved?
It was resolved by my taking libel action in Germany in court and winning the case.
How did that story come up? What have you since found out about it?
There was a writer, and I haven't found out much about it. I don't speak German, so I was unable to read the articles in question, and as a matter of fact, unable to read the pieces that were I was accused of plagiarizing. So I still don't know a lot about it, except that a writer in a German publication made this accusation, and it was false, and I proved it in court.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense that there's been a slowing down of the anti-nuclear movement?
Yes, there has been.
What do you think that's a response to?
It just seems that it's not something that people can bear to keep in the forefront of their minds for very long at a time. Actually, that's one reason I think that it's useful to have an intellectual grasp of it, too, because intellectually you can hold it in your mind and kind of thereby remember what you felt and thought in those moments when you faced it emotionally. Because that's the problem with this issue, is that we think about it, we get horrified, and then we forget about it again. So I think a good, solid intellectual grasp can sort of cover us in the period when we're just unable to look at it emotionally. And that seems to be simply human. I wouldn't urge anybody to try to go around with a full feeling of the horror of nuclear war every minute of the day.
I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Well, thank you.
Jonathan Schell's new collection, Observing the Nixon Years, is published by Pantheon Books. This is Fresh Air. Herbert Siegel is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, no doubt you're covering the investigation of Jim Wright.
We are. We'll be hearing from Cokie Roberts on Capitol Hill about the House Ethics Committee's report on Speaker Jim Wright. We'll also be hearing from Daniel Shore on that subject. Also, you know, in Poland today, Solidarity was registered as a legal organization after all these years since martial law was imposed. We'll be hearing about that and from an editor who has been underground all these years, who now will be working in an above-ground newspaper or magazine. Also, Terry, have you ever wanted to be a rock and roll star? Oh, come on, say
it. Well, in my secret fantasy life, sure.
Well, we'll talk to the people who'll take your money to make your fantasy come true.
I don't think I have enough of that. Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of television's critically acclaimed but short-lived series has found new life on cable TV. David Bianculli has a review.
You want to know the difference between a TV show that you like and a TV show that you love? When you love a show, you get all excited when you hear the opening theme song because you know you're going to enjoy what comes next. Right now, that happens to me with the theme songs to The Wonder Years and Wise Guy, and to an old favorite that returns with new episodes this week on Lifetime Cable. Yes, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd is back. The show that was mistreated and canceled by NBC has been rescued and revived by a basic cable network. The whole cast of Molly Dodd is back for these new shows, but you won't see all of them in the premiere, which, if you miss Monday's telecast, is repeated this Saturday. As always, though, Blair Brown as Molly is in virtually every scene, and I can't think of any better reason to watch a TV show than that. She's the best actress on series television, period. This new season on a new network begins, fittingly, with an episode set on New Year's Eve. Molly has quit her job at the bookstore and suspended her relationship with its owner, Moss, who's left for Switzerland. Everyone Molly knows is having more luck with men and with life than she is. Even her mother, played by Alan Ann McClary, has a new boyfriend and doesn't like the fact that her daughter is both unenthusiastic and unemployed.
Is it me, or are you unusually hormonal?
Mom, I made a decision. You see, I've mastered the job. They've got this antiquated system down there. They're not about to let me change it. It was the end of the year. I felt like I was in limbo. It was time to move on, and it was my life. And there's another list.
Just because he went to Switzerland doesn't mean he's never coming back.
Moss had nothing to do with this. Well, he had something to do with it, but not everything. The walls were closing in on me.
I hope you don't regret it, that's all.
Well, I hope not to. I mean, after all, I could have eventually become one of the top sales clerks in all of Greenwich Village. And after that, who knows? There would be the Sales Clerk Olympics, the Sales Clerk Hall of Fame. Like, just give me a break, okay?
Forgive me if I'm thinking of your, forgive the expression, welfare.
Each Molly Dodd episode is like a little Woody Allen movie, beautifully written, perfectly performed, and without a laugh track to insult your intelligence. Intelligence, in fact, is the secret ingredient of the days and nights of Molly Dodd. Everyone has it, including Davy the Doorman, who's played with such understatement by James Green.
So, you making any? Resolutions.
Yes, I'm going to wise up and stop trusting people because essentially they're all liars, and I'm going to buy a new toaster oven.
Good, strong set of priorities, albeit somewhat cynical.
Not the toaster oven.
No, that's a positive step forward.
The old year and the new show both end with Molly in her apartment. She's watching TV coverage of the ball falling on Times Square, but she's not alone. It's a hopeful start to a new year, a new batch of Molly Dodd shows, and the first reason to find Lifetime on your cable converter. The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd is just as good as it used to be on NBC. It's moved on, but it hasn't sold out.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a look into the mind of comic Jonathan Winters. He's a master of improvisation and impersonation, and he says his loneliness as an only child led him to create some of his more enduring characters. Also, remember Ichiku Park? It was the one hit by the British band Small Faces. Next time, rock historian Ed Ward tells what happened to the band before and after. And book critic John Leonard reviews Accident, A Day's News, the new novel from Krista Wolfe. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Doherty, Fred Landrell, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.